Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you so much, Audrey. You are indeed so kind, and you just made it in tonight. Audrey's been out visiting with family, as many people today on Thanksgiving, and we're very pleased that she could be with us again tonight. She's never missed a show. They're absolutely incredible. And we broadcast from all over the place, haven't we, in remote broadcasts, etc. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Keith Haley, your host for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network. And we want to thank Johnny Cash again for getting us started as he takes that trip across 90 cities and states in the United States. And John, I hope you had some time tonight to stop someplace and get some turkey. So, Emily and Mike, thank you for joining us tonight, and we're off on another good show. It's Thanksgiving. I hope you folks had a great one out there tonight, and several people that might be listening to us tonight, it's actually more than that. We appreciate you joining us tonight, and you know, on Thanksgiving, I always think of that that slogan they put up on the wall, that quote, the wall of Texas prisons, at least some of the Texas prisons I've been in, that says, count your blessings and then recount them. You probably miss some. I don't know how big a kick prisoners get out of that, but I think it's a real good one. But I had a great Thanksgiving today, and perhaps I'll tell you more about that later. The purpose of our show, ladies and gentlemen, is like it always is. It's to discuss news issues and events and developments in this very interesting and always changing field of criminal justice. And some of the things that go on are very serious and complex and detailed, and some things are light and humorous. And we try to make a blend of some of those things on the radio show each week. And we dedicate our show to these tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals that protect us throughout the United States and throughout the world. I'm going to let out a little leak here tonight, and I hope it's going to happen. But we're working on an arrangement that perhaps we're going to be able to get, don't know how sure this is, but it's a possibility. We've got the contact working now, that perhaps we will have the chief of police of the Istanbul, Turkey Police Department. Wouldn't that be something? And very interesting gentleman, of course, and incredible responsibilities in a nation the size of Turkey and in the city of Istanbul. So we'll let you know more about that as the week progresses. But if it's going to come off, I think we'll try to pull it off here in the next two or three weeks. Well, what we try to do in this show is, like I'm talking about, is look inside criminal justice practice and take a close look at its professionals also. We do this on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and if you haven't got your own show yet, I encourage you to do that. Alan Liebley, we always pay tribute to him every week. He's the CEO of the Blog Talk Radio Network and the genius behind what happens here. And if you haven't looked at the Blog Talk schedule in a long time, you have literally thousands of shows on every subject imaginable. You can listen to them absolutely free, and you can download them and keep them and replay them as you wish. But beyond that, it's possible for any person, any interest group, any organization, any person, to have their own show broadcast live and streaming audio over the Internet worldwide. Listen to this to an unlimited number of listeners, and the cost is absolutely free. I'm not sure everybody gets that the first time through, but it means you can have a radio show that goes worldwide, and you can probably do it 14, 15, 16 hours a week. I'm not sure what that is anymore, but I know it's at least probably that much. These shows are archived almost immediately, and they're available for replay and download to MP3, podcast, do whatever you want. We know that folks do use these, as I have speakers on the shows and some other content once in a while. They are, in fact, used in college classes across places in the United States. So get your own show. It's well worth it. Give it a try. It may be your next career. Well, tonight's show is going to be a little different in the sense that you've probably realized that I'm a fan of old-time radio. Grew up listening to radio and mystery shows and read mysteries and that type of thing. But tonight we're going to have a broadcast of one of Philip Marlowe's Lady and Mink detective shows. If you know much about Philip Marlowe, interesting character. Of course, he's the work of Raymond Chandler, and he came in behind Dashiell Hammett and Sam Spade in the late 1940s. About 1947, they started the Philip Marlowe show. And in the movies about Philip Marlowe, we've had Dick Powell play the part, but in the radio show, they started off with Van Heflin. And what's interesting about Philip Marlowe, as a detective, he's not your usual hard-banging Dashiell Hammett, Sam Spade type, but he can do all that, but he also plays chess, he listens to classical music, and he went to college in late 1940s for a radio show detective. That was indeed unusual. So I think you'll enjoy this show tonight, Lady and Mink, and if you like those old-time radio shows, you can go to archive.org and the old-time radio network on the Internet and some other sites, and they're just loaded there. I don't think people have any idea how many of these old radio shows are actually stored there for your use, and you can listen to them. So I think it's going to be interesting. You can call in tonight during the news section if you want to, on 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983. And what we can do on our switchboard is hold as many as five people at one time, and we can have a chat about whatever you like, as long as it has something to do with criminal justice or perhaps one of our news stories that we're going to talk about tonight. Now, tonight, Audrey, I know you have a very special blonde joke. It was sent to me by a friend. And he sends it in the right spirit, the spirit of humor. And Audrey, it's apropos of, I think, our holiday today, isn't it? Correct? I think so. Let's hear it.
Professor Haley, tonight's blonde joke could be interpreted as a little mean, but I do not intend it to be so. I hope it is received in the spirit of good humor and the occasion of Thanksgiving. Here it is, sir. 1 year of Thanksgiving, my mom went to my sister's house for the traditional feast. Knowing how gullible my sister is, my mom decided to play a trick. She told my sister that she needed something from the store. When my sister left, my mom took the turkey out of the oven, removed the stuffing, stuffed a Cornish hen, and inserted it into the turkey, and restuffed the turkey. She then placed the turkey back into the oven. When it was time for dinner, my sister pulled the turkey out of the oven and proceeded to remove the stuffing. When her serving spoon hit something, she reached in and pulled out the little bird. With a look of total shock on her face, my mother exclaimed, "Patricia, you've cooked a pregnant bird." At the reality of this horrifying news, my sister started to cry. It took the family 3 hours to convince her that turkeys lay eggs. Folks, you guessed it. She's a blonde.
Right, that's a good one. Let's put that in the top drawer. We'll save that and use it next Thanksgiving if we're still on the air. And ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms has put out a public service announcement that we'd like to replay in the interest of reducing gun violence and getting guns off the street. I may make a point about this tonight, that gun sales seem to be up all over the United States, and what people are fearing, I think this happens every time you get a new president, regardless of what political party it is, but what they fear is some type of new regulation where certain guns will be outlawed and put on a weapons list that you can't purchase them anymore. And I was talking to a friend of mine who said that sales are up certainly in the Dallas area, and it's probably like that over the United States. I browsed around just a little bit to check out that claim on the internet here in the last couple of days, and it does seem like there's a lot of things going on in terms of places on the net where you can buy firearms. So before the prices go up, if you're interested in purchasing your first or lighter firearm, then this might be the time to actually do it. But anyway, the Ohio Coalition has this public service announcement, and it's directed toward the street criminals and the gangbangers and the thugs and the armed robbers, and we're hoping that they'll hear this and turn in their weapons.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, and we hope that the appropriate people hear that, or the targeted people hear that that announcement and, in fact, turn in their firearms and turn away from crime. Well, let's do a little bit of criminal justice news tonight. Some interesting things going on. One of them absolutely surprises me, and I'll make that our second story tonight, but this is kind of an interesting one here, a case that occurred in Germany. And can you believe that a prisoner mailed himself to freedom? That sounds like something you'd see on or hear about in a cartoon or in a movie, right? But it actually happened. Here's what happened. An inmate escaped from jail in Germany by posting himself out of prison in a giant FedEx box that carries the dirty laundry. Apparently this prison sends their dirty laundry out by FedEx. They come and pick up the thing, and he put himself in a box, wrapped himself up in the sheets in a large box. When the package was loaded onto the van, they drove out through the gates, and he waited till the driver made his next stop before he got out of the box. He picked the lock on the back of the van, and he ran off into a nearby woods. And then he was discovered that he was missing after the driver sold the empty box and realized that the lock to his van had been picked from the inside. The spokesman for the police actually said that. He says, it sounds like something that only happens in the movies, but it actually happened to us. So mail yourself to freedom. Very, very interesting idea. Now, this is one that I don't understand. I suppose from a police policy standpoint, the liability and things of that nature, you could do this, but here's what's going on in the Austin Police Department. Once in a while, criminals run from you, and once in a while, police officers chase them on foot. We're not talking about automobile chases here. We're talking about foot chases. Well, the Austin Police Department has established a new policy. It says from now on, officers in that agency will have to ask themselves a long list of questions before chasing criminal suspects by foot. Now, my first thought about that is how much time you have to think about answering these questions, but according to the newspaper, it says police officers must evaluate the immediate danger. They must consider whether a suspect is known and can be arrested later. And then, folks, they need to ask themselves what would be gained from pursuing the suspect before beginning foot chases. Now, I'm trying to think, is that a hard question to answer? It seems like what would be gained is you would be catching a criminal, but perhaps there's something there I'm missing. the two-page document for this policy says the officer should consider whether a suspect may be armed and the availability of backup officers, and it requires them to radio a description of the suspect and a location of the chase to dispatchers. One commentator says that's quite a lot to ask yourself, or ask a police officer to think about before he or she decides to make a split-second decision to go out and chase one. They did have an unfortunate case where a female officer was actually killed by her partner in a car when she was doing a foot chase. I think that happened a year and a half ago or something in Austin. But Assistant Police Chief David Carter, who was the department's chief of staff, said that the chief initially began changes to the policy soon after taking over the department last year. He says any time that you have something where you have a tactical consideration where somebody, either a police officer or a suspect, could be injured, the department needs to establish some kind of training and a policy. Quite frankly, personally, I'm not a big policy liker, so to speak. I think that we can over, if it's a profession, we don't lock officers down in policy. We allow them to use their professional judgment. But we have some of these policy manuals in police departments are you know, they're 3 and 4 stacks of notebooks with a policy for almost everything imaginable. And I don't know, that doesn't seem like a profession to me, but I've argued with people about this this for years. So anyway, I can recall once back in the Ice Age actually chasing someone in a downtown area, a grand larcenist sharplifter, substantially over the limit for grand larceny. And we ran all around the place, and finally he kicked off his shoes, and lo and behold, I think I did the exact same thing, and after a while we caught him, and he was about dead when I caught him, so he was easy apprehension once he fell down. But anyway, I don't know what, I'd be interested in anybody's comments about that. Should we say the police officer's got to go through all that just to chase someone? I'm not sure that makes a lot of sense. This is kind of an interesting one. All over the country, of course, there are budget restrictions now and constraints and this type of thing. But what do you think about the idea of putting police on a shift like firefighters? In other words, beyond 24 and off 48. And the 24 hours, we're not talking about like some of the public safety departments did. You work 8 hours in the police car and then 16 in the firehouse, of which most of that time might be, or at least some of that time would be sleeping. Here they're talking about having the cops actually work 24 hours before they get off duty. And this is Harper Woods, Michigan, that's actually considering these 24-hour shifts. The city has a population of about 13,000. Covers about 2.6 square miles, and it's lost $600,000 to $700,000 this year from state revenue sharing funds. They think they need to do something. He says our fire department's on 24-hour shifts, but again, on the 24 hours, believe me, fire department job, you wouldn't get me in that for all the money in the world. I'd rather look for a burglar in a dark building anytime than I would enter a building that's on fire. But anyway, it says they're on 24-hour shifts, but I don't think it's the same thing. I mean, you actually sleep during that 24 hours, at least I would imagine most of the time. But extending the hours of extremely tired police officers, I think, is a dangerous situation for things like a foot chase or driving tactfully to stop a car or to block a car, that type of thing. It just doesn't make sense to me. Again, let's keep on the budget constraint idea. Jump down to San Antonio, Texas, and they're implementing something they call smart policing, program called SMART. Guess you can't do anything nowadays unless you've got a program that's an acronym. And this is a strategic management for accelerated response times. Yes, let me get that right. Strategic management for accelerated response times. Sounds fancy, as the article commentator says. Well, it's actually pretty simple. Facing these budget cuts, what they're actually going to do, that officers are no longer going to respond to any crime that's nonviolent. In other words, a burglary, a car theft, damaging of a car, anything of that nature, the police are not going to respond to that. They're going to require you to go to the internet and fill out a form, and then they'll send you a complaint number by email. Let me see, serving the public. How do you think that registers with a lot of people? They ask some, and, you know, police officers, one person says here, Louis Gallardo, he says, police officers need to pay attention to all calls. He doesn't like the idea either. He says, when I call, or another person says, when I call, I don't want to waste time on a computer. I want to see a live person. So it'll be interesting to see how this comes out in San Antonio if they actually do it. But I don't think it makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, you can be diverted from calls, which happens all the time. You're on a lesser type of priority call, and something else comes up. Well, you leave it and go take the most important call. But to actually ignore all nonviolent type of offense calls is incredible. You're talking about a lot of felonies here. I think burglars are going to be very pleased to hear this because they can go home with the goods and not face any fear of being apprehended, at least right away. This last news story I thought was interesting, and those of you who listen often or once in a while probably know I'm working on an article I'm going to present in the spring, and also a book on surveillance and continuous surveillance in society. The book title is called I See You, The Logic and Lunacy of Continuous Surveillance. I won't go into this because we've done other shows you can go back and listen to about the issue of surveillance and hear some of my perspectives on this. I understand the logic of it, and I think I've identified some of the lunacy of it, but this is kind of an interesting one that relates to it in an odd way. It has to do with audio surveillance of police officers while they're working in their cruiser. In Maryland, Montgomery County Circuit Court Judge Ron Rubin has just ruled that the county's plan to record conversations in police cruisers does not violate the state's wiretap laws or infringe on the privacy of police officers. So what's going to happen here, this is going on all over the country, they are going to be listening to what police officers say in the cruisers. So in other words, I suppose if you have a partner, you're having to chat about this or that or whatever, that's going to be something that supervisors or some type of monitor can listen to, and perhaps they're even recording it, and it can be listened to at some later time. And what the court, the judge said, that there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in an officer's patrol car. I suppose most everybody could make a case for that position. I mean, you're in a public function, you're doing public duty, you're on the job, you don't really own the cruiser, so to speak. He said there's no reasonable expectation of privacy when an individual has a conversation with a police officer either, with few exceptions, such as those cases where perhaps it would be, I could think, a confidential informant talking or something like that. Since there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in a patrol car or in conversations with police officers, then the state's wiretap law is not implicated. The FOP, Lodge 35, in Maryland, filed this complaint, and they had argued that the county's plan to set up audio and video equipment in cruisers violated the state's wiretap law. And I suppose that meant that you had to have the consent of at least one or perhaps both parties that are being wiretapped or listened to, surveilled, audio surveilled. So interesting subject. I mean, you're seeing this audio surveillance now all over the place. I mentioned a news story not too long ago where the red light company, camera companies are actually saying, look what we can do now. We can actually do 360-degree audio surveillance for you also. So we can put your red light camera on the corner, but we can also monitor conversations all around. And, of course, the next thing is probably the micro-expression readers where we can tell what you're thinking or how you feel on the corner. To me, this gets into kind of the lunacy of continuous surveillance, but we'll have to see how this turns out. But as a working police officer, I don't know, you know, it's not that you're going to be saying anything wrong with anybody in a work setting, but do you need everything that you do? Does it need to be monitored in an audio version, or surveillance for that matter. People work under something. To me, it seems like surveillance is a little more palatable than the audio monitoring. But anyway, we'll have to see how this turns out, and I'd be interested to see what folks think about this over the long haul. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think what we're going to do now is go ahead and go to our story. And keep in mind, this is a detective series that started. It went off and on. In fact, Raymond Chandler wasn't pleased with the first few shows. And they did a little retooling of the show. And then later on, actually, in the 50s, the show went down to 15 minutes. But it was very popular. It was on CBS for a considerable period of time. And again, Philip Marlowe was a different type of detective. He college educated, went to college, played chess, listened to classical music, had some other type of astute sort of interests. And I think what you'll like in this is the dialogue is very good, because if you've ever read a Ray Chandler mystery, you know that it's rich in description and narrative and simile. Just a really outstanding writer. So here we go with Raymond Chandler's case of the Lady in Mink, starring the detective Philip Marlowe, played by Van Heflin.
The thick fog that clung to Los Angeles made searching for the girl who was going to kill herself slow and uneasy. But in the end, I'd have settled for that and more, because murder happened twice before I found the Lady in Mink.
From the pen of Raymond Chandler, outstanding author of crime fiction, comes his most famous character in The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. With Gerald Moore, starred as Philip Marlowe, we bring you tonight's exciting story, The Lady in Mink.
By Pacific Coast time, it was only 5 o'clock in the afternoon. But the dense, billowing fog that was heavy over everything, like a huge, thick hand, said it could be midnight. And Los Angeles could be London in May, December. So when I got out of my car and walked toward the plugs of red neon that marked the hotel cocktail lounge where I was to meet my new client, Grace Tyler, I felt all alone and a little sorry that I wasn't in some nice, cozy 9-to-5 business that would leave me heading for home now. And maybe an evening with people who like to laugh. But when I was inside the lounge, which was imitation hunting lodge and friendly, I perked up some. My client was young and almost pretty, with dark, shingled hair dressed in somber gray, and wore not enough makeup. Her eyes were swollen and red from crying. When I introduced myself, she tried to come right to the point.
Mr. Marlowe, I have to find my sister.
Oh, take it easy, honey. That won't do it. Who is your sister?
Sorry.
It's all right.
Her name is June Drake, Mr. Marlowe, and she's in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I got this letter from her here.
Yeah. Trapped, no way out, take my own life. Hateful people, this is to say goodbye. Who's this Melnick she mentions? Do you know him, Mrs. Tyler?
No, I never heard the name Melnick before. I'm Miss Tyler.
Oh.
My sister was the married one, Mr. Marlowe. Her husband was Hugh Drake. He died a few years ago.
I see. Have you been to the police with this?
No, because... Well, you see, Mr. Marlowe, June is... She's different. More full of fun than I am, and well... She gets around, and sometimes with strange people. Dangerous ones.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. Grace, what does your sister look like?
Well, she's about my height. She has long red hair, and she's pretty, Mr. Marlowe. Very pretty.
Mm. Aside from her looks, anything else? Car, clothes?
Clothes, yes, definitely. She always dresses well. Except that she's overly fond of furs. Most of the time, she wears a mink stole.
Stole, huh? Kind of a cape?
Yes,
yeah, I see.
June has an apartment in Beverly Hills, Mr. Marlowe. 3300 Rexford Drive.
Mm-hmm.
I went there, but it was locked. The neighbors say she left for New York a week ago, and yet I...
Yes, she couldn't have, because this letter was mailed here in town only yesterday. Is that it?
Yes. Oh, please, Mr. Marlowe, do something. Here's $50. I'll pay more if only you'll hurry.
No, that'll do it. Where can I get in touch with you, Grace?
I'm staying here at the Beverly Crest Hotel. I don't live in Los Angeles.
Well, it's a starter. I think I'll try number 3300, Rexford Drive. I'll call you later. Goodbye, Grace. Outside, the fog felt about the same. But there was more of it, so I was 15 minutes getting to June Drake's apartment, which was a ground floor arrangement, already in about the size and shape of the Air Bowl. I was only half that time outsmarting the cheap lock on the back door, drawing all the blinds shut inside, and turning on a single light. But then there was no place. There were clothes in the closets, prettier ones in the bureau drawers, and it went on like that for 45 more minutes. Everything just as it should be and no lead, until I was ready to leave. Then on a coffee table, I saw something that stood out in that nest for the idle rich like an ear-to-ear grin on an undertaker. It was a book of matches advertising Duke Gray's Billiard Academy, 3rd and Main, where particular pool players congregate. That and the name Melnick had to dovetail, or I was licked. The next hour was a lucky one. I found the Duke himself, who both knew and despised Melnick, whom he described as a hardly ever sober dirty word, front name Frank, who lived 3rd floor rear at the Palace Arms, a tired walk-up also on Main Street. So at exactly 9 o'clock, I walked the length of a filthy corridor, stopped and knocked the knuckles on my right hand almost raw before the door inched open. And a pair of shifty eyes and a puffy, pasty face blinked out at me.
Yeah? What do you want?
If you're Frank Melnick, conversation.
I'm not dressed for it, honest.
This isn't a social call. Mr. Melnick!
Hey, what do you think you're doing, shoving your way into my room? Who do you think you are?
Name's Marlowe. I'm looking for June Drake.
June... I don't know any June Drake. Honest.
You don't convince me, Melnick. Now shake the fuzz off your brain and start remembering, or you'll find yourself in trouble up to your eyebrows.
Okay, okay, I know her.
When'd you last see her?
3 weeks ago. Maybe a month ago. But she's an acquaintance from my hometown, that's all. Honest.
You're a liar. June Drake would brush you off like a piece of lint, and you know it.
Listen, I'm as good as she is any day. Don't forget that.
Get your hands off me, Melnick.
Now, get out of here. Go on.
I told you once, Melnick. Let go! Okay, now start talking. Give it to me straight the first time or I'll get real mad. Come on, get up!
Okay. There's a guy named Jaffe, Hugh Jaffe. He's June's boyfriend. That's all I know. Honest.
All right. What's this stuff, these clippings and these pictures here?
I used to be a photographer. Honest.
Until your lens got bloodshot, huh?
Yeah, on the Salinas Herald Star.
All right, Melnick, what's Hugh Jaffe's address?
It's 2001 North Beechwood Drive.
Thanks, I'll try it. But if you're not telling me the truth, Melnick, I'll be back. Honest.
Yes? You want what, Daniel?
Mr. Hugh Jaffe.
He's not here. I am Margarita Jaffe, his wife. What do you want with him?
A few words, Mrs. Jaffe. Do you expect him soon?
Since he does not live here anymore, no.
Oh. You and Hugh are divorced, eh? I didn't know that.
And I did not say that. Now, what are you looking for?
June Drake.
What do you want to know about that?
I want to know where that is. Can you help me?
No, I cannot. I do not know and I do not care. But when you find her, senor, I hope you find her dead.
If I'd have followed the approved technique, I'd have lost a leg on the lady's threshold. And I was about to lean on a doorbell again to try once more for an address on Mr. Hugh Jaffe. And I saw I didn't need to. Because stuck over the mailbox was a letter forwarded to him at 41 Peacock Lane, Brentwood, California. Which was a half-hour drive due west of Hollywood. 30 fog-filled minutes later, Hugh Jaffe and I exchanged introductions and I stated my purpose. And I stumbled behind him through a 2-inch thick rug that ended in an oak-paneled library, where he cigarred me, then settled back and waited. We looked at each other until it became embarrassing. Then he opened.
Marlowe, I wish I could help you, but I haven't seen or heard of June Drake in over 3 weeks.
Well, I was under the impression that you two were on closer terms, Mr. Jaffe, if you don't mind my mentioning it.
Not at all. He used to be, but all that's changed now. She was too expensive for me. Lovely creature, but terribly vain.
Now that she's out of the picture, you're going back to your wife.
No, huh? I'm not. Frankly, Marlowe, my, shall I say, infatuation for June has completely destroyed everything Margarita and I ever had.
Which I suppose makes divorce the next step?
Sure, I wish it were that easy. She refuses to give me a divorce, Marlowe. Her way of striking back.
Yeah, I know what you're getting at. I had a brief chat with Mrs. Jaffe myself. Well, if you hear from June, get in touch with me, will you? I'll appreciate it.
Of course. I'll be happy to help in any way I can. And please, Marlowe, call me if you find her, hmm? The number here is Crestview 89122.
Yeah, I'll remember it. Even if I find her dead.
Dead? What do you mean? Why that?
Well, from where I stand, Mr. Jaffe, June Drake is dynamite. And that stuff can blow up right in your face, huh? When you least expect it. Good night. Sure, it was double talk, but sometimes swinging wide and praying for a lucky punch beats waiting in your corner. Besides, that was as far as I could go on the book of matches. So after slowly walking a block through the chilling fog, I found a phone, called my client, and brought her up to date on the Jaffe Triangle and my own contention that if June Drake didn't try actually to kill herself, Senora Margarita Jaffe might. That Grace wouldn't buy.
No, no, Mr. Marlowe, I can't believe that.
Well, maybe you just don't want to. But either way, there's still Frank Melnick. We've already met Grace, and believe me, he's got all the charm of a black widow spider.
What does this Melnick do, Mr. Marlowe?
Yeah, he's a drunk. He used to be a photographer for some paper, the Salinas Herald Star.
Salinas?
Yeah.
Why, Mr. Marlowe, June used to live in Salinas when she was married to Stu Drake.
You sure, Grace?
Positive.
Grace, how did June's husband die?
Stu?
Yeah.
He was killed in a car wreck. Drove it over a cliff. Mm-hmm. June just got out in time. Nobody knew exactly how it happened. It was a terrible accident.
Maybe. You might as well face it, honey, because the chances are slim that that's the whole story.
What?
Look, Grace, suppose something else happened, like June being responsible for Stu's death.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and Melnick, the photographer, with a picture to prove it. You know, a small case of blackmail.
Oh, no. No, Phil, you're wrong. She wouldn't kill. I know that.
Okay,
she
okay. She's your sister, honey. I'll do the dirty guesswork for both of us until we get some proof. And right now, that makes back to the hacienda of one Senora Jaffe my best bet. Because the lady there is both jealous and hot-tempered, a daily double that always runs in the money. So long, baby.
Goodbye.
When I got back to my car and pointed to the 2001 North Beachwood Drive again, I was feeling pretty low because no matter which way I added things, June Drake always came out a minus, which wasn't good. But sometimes lady had a real sweet sister. But then I told myself it was still the fog making the good look better and the bad worse. And to concentrate on my driving and the facts I had to go on. When I did just that, I took my foot off the accelerator and slammed it down onto the brake hard. But it suddenly occurred to me that I was going the wrong way. Because if I was right about Frank Melnick being a blackmailer and June Drake a killer, the Senora would keep a lot longer than the drinking man in the Palace Arms, third floor, rear. Three quarters of an hour getting back down to Main Street, but even as I started up the foul smelling rickety stairs, a small voice inside kept telling me that I was too late. But a second later, as I moved quietly toward Melnick's door, two other voices, not so small and coming from the room in question, said otherwise. Said that Melnick was still around and as healthy as ever, but better than that, that his guest is the lady my client was paying me to find, a lady named June Drake. All of which made this a good time for my right hand and the .38 in my pocket to get together while I listened carefully. Then moved closer until I was next to the door.
Oh, an empty gin bottle.
Open up, Melnick, before I blast my way in. Come on.
Marlowe, get out of here. Okay, wise guy, wait a minute.
For what? The lady's exodus? I warned you, Melnick, get back.
Hey, what's the matter with you? What are you doing?
Looking for June Drake, remember? Now, where is she?
What are you talking about? I'm alone in here.
Yeah? You always talk to yourself in a high voice, don't you? That window to the fire escape there is always open on foggy nights, too, isn't it? Listen, smart guy, I want to know where she... Wait a minute, the snake stove here. Maybe it doesn't matter where she went. Maybe she'll be back after she thinks I'm gone.
I don't think so. You see, mister, June Drake never left. She's right behind you, stupid!
Yes.
Oh.
In just a moment, the second act of Philip Marlowe. But first, you'll find both pleasure and a chance for profit when you listen to Sing It Again, CBS's hour-long Saturday night cavalcade of melody, riddles, and prizes. your chance for the greatest prize in radio, $53,000. When Sing It Again comes your way over most of these same CBS network stations later tonight, be sure you're listening. $53,000. It might be yours. Now, with our star, Gerald Moore, we return to the second act of Philip Marlowe and tonight's story, The Lady in Mink.
Maybe Jane Drake had used the spiked heel of a shoe, maybe the butt of a pistol, but either way, it didn't matter because on the way to the floor, I bounced once off the sharp corner of an end table, and this was why all the lights in the world had gone out for me at once. Hours they blinked on again one at a time, and I dragged myself hand over hand along the length of the iron bedpost until I was standing. I saw there was blood oozing from a cut on the right side of my face. But as the two rooms focused into one again, I forgot about the slightly battered Marlowe and concentrated instead on an open newspaper lying at my feet. Because written across it with an eyebrow pencil in firm but feminine hand were the words, "Grace, call off your private detective. It's too late to help me. I'm near the end. But before I go, I'm going to take the two people with me who have wrecked my life. Goodbye, June." At that, I started for the door and a hall phone to call the police. But then I stopped. Conscious for the first time of the half circle of hushed, gaping faces and bathrobes that stood in the doorway. The gaping faces that weren't turned toward me, but over to a shadowed corner where, face down in a pool of his own blood, was the dead form of Frank Melnick. In the middle of his back, an ice pick, red to the hilt. Marlowe Mooney, where's he bar at?
He had to go out of town.
Oh. Well, look, Mooney, I'm at a place called the Palace Arms on Main near 4th. Third floor rear. There's a man named Frank Melnick with an ice pick in his back. Very dead.
Know who he is, Marlowe?
Yeah, an ex-newspaper photographer. A drunk and, I think, a blackmailer in reverse order.
Any idea who did it?
Uh-huh. One June Drake. A red-headed lady in mink. Was out to kill herself just as soon as she tidies up her affairs a bit, which I think includes killing again. So if you'll put out a call for her... The mink, by the way, is a cape. The lady, young and about 5'6". I'll try to get to what I think is her next stop before she does. Call you later. When I got through to my client and broke the news, she gasped and kept repeating no in a small, strained voice that kicked at the lining of my insides no matter how fast I talked. So in one breath, I told her that I was going first for Margarita Jaffe, then her husband, either of whom could be next on June Drake's final agenda. And I gave her the Crestview phone number that Hugh Jaffe had given me. Told her to call me there in an hour, hung up and ran for my car in 2001, North Beechwood Drive. Feeling punk. It was a minute better than midnight when I got there, and it was 10 wet, dripping minutes more before the door finally opened. A hatchet-faced housekeeper with a stocking on her head said that Mrs. Jaffe had left a half hour ago, saying something about meeting a woman. And the housekeeper would have said more, but I was already back in my car heading for Brentwood, number 41, Peacock Lane. There, the Oriental houseboy said the boss man was busy playing poker in the den. And something stronger than Esperanto, I made it clear that my business was more important. A minute later, a door opened on the far side of the room.
Excuse me, gentlemen. Well, aren't you working a little late tonight, Marlowe?
Murder isn't always done during office hours, Mr. Jaffe.
Murder?
Yeah, with a nice pick at that. Tell me, have you heard from your wife or June Drake tonight?
No, of course not. Why do you ask?
Because June Drake just killed a man named Melnick.
Killed a man? Why, that's...
That's what, Mr. Jaffe?
That's hard to believe.
Why? Because it was a man? What were you expecting?
Don't be absurd, Marlowe. I was expecting nothing like this at all. It's a shock to me. Excuse me. I'll take it myself, Jung, in the dining room. I'll be with you in a minute, Marlowe.
All right, Mr. Jaffe. Make it fast, will you? Love to listen and telephone.
June, listen to me. You don't know what... Wait a minute. The private detective here, I think, is listening in on the extension.
It doesn't matter. Nobody can stop me now. It's what? I'm leaving tonight. I only called to tell you that you don't have to worry anymore, that I won't be any...
Never mind that. Where are you, June? Tell me.
I'm not in San Motion. Wait until... But don't try to do anything new. It's too late. Much too late. Goodbye.
Pretty talkative.
Marlo, Marlowe, you heard that, didn't you?
Yeah, I heard it all. You heard that too, didn't you? I didn't like it, Jaffe, so... Oh, don't bother. This one's mine. I'm expecting it. Hello?
Hello, I want to... Oh, is that you, Marlowe?
Yeah. Look, Grace, your sister just called and... Well, it doesn't look too good, honey.
Oh, Grace called here. Oh, but Phil, where is she? Do you know? Is she all right?
No, no, she isn't, Grace. Any way you look at it. Now, tell me, where are you?
At my place, but there is no place.
All right, now stay there. I'll talk to you as soon as I can, Grace. Goodbye.
But where are you going?
Thanks for your cooperation, Jaffe. Been a lot of help. I'll also talk to you as soon as I can. Believe me. I got outside, piled into my car, and took off. I didn't know if I was racing to keep a mixed-up girl from committing suicide or going after a murderer who was scheduled to kill again. I was 20 precious minutes following the Wriggle at Sunset Boulevard from Brentwood to Santa Monica, where it hits into US 101 that parallels the Pacific. And out there with the fog even thicker, I was 20 minutes again finding the Ocean Way Hotel. The landlady there was a fat henna blonde with a mouthful of gold and foul language. She said that she never heard of a June Drake until I lied that I was an L.A. cop and described the girl as a lot of red hair flowing over a mink stole that could be using any name. Then she told me that what I called June had just been a woman visitor a little while ago. But that we started down a short corridor to a rented room, fast.
I wouldn't do this for no one but a cop. Better believe me, we both better be talking about the same girl. There's no fuss at this hour than now. It's a room there.
No light on. I thought you said she had a visitor.
Maybe the visitor went home. What do you expect? 2 o'clock in the morning.
Not a peep. Come on, open it up.
Open it up. Now it tells me. He's got my keys. They're over on the other side in the room.
Okay, then we'll get in the hard way.
You better not to bust my door.
Take it easy, Blondie. You're in for a shock. Okay, turn the lights on.
Oh. That's the woman that visited her.
Yeah. Spanish woman known as Margarita Jaffe. Ice pick and all.
I better get a little air over here by the window. I don't feel so good.
And I better get to a phone and... Hey, there's a cigarette over there. It's still smoldering. She may not be very far away.
Brother, you said a mouthful. Come here and look.
What is it? What do you see?
Right there. Near the pier under that street. Ain't that the one you're after?
Where? Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Red hair and mink stolen
clothes. She's
seen us. Right out to the end of the pier.
She's running.
Call the cops. Blondie, sit tight. Yeah. I'll see you later. By the time I got out to the street and across where we'd seen her, she was already out onto the pier. I caught one glimpse of her red hair and then nothing but the fog that swallowed her up like she was made of smoke. I ran toward the spot where she had disappeared and tried to yell over the crash of the waves for her to come back when I heard it. After that, things happened fast. From somewhere, the cop on the beat, then Blondie, then a couple of scared kids who'd been necking in a car, and then more.
I knew it. I saw her pass me a couple of minutes ago. Dressed too nice. I should have stopped her.
Mr. Cheejump?
Yeah. Officer, shine your light over there, will you? I thought I saw something move.
Okay, but in this fog, we won't be able to see much. Besides, for those waves and the undertow around here, she hasn't got a chance.
Maybe not. You never can tell. Hey, move the light over a little. To your left. Yeah, that's it. There on the piling.
I don't see nothing there. Just a greasy pole. Here, look. On that cross piece near the water line on the piling. What's that, Burge?
Yeah, that was hers, all right.
What is it, mister?
That blondie's a very valuable fur. A stole made of mink. I never could figure where people came from at 3 o'clock in the morning when something nasty happened. But they always do. Some come to help, some just to stare, and others maybe to see if they can take it. An hour after I'd heard June Drake scream, we'd found nothing but the stole. I couldn't take any more. Maybe it was still the fog. Maybe it was the thought that in a hotel room up in Beverly Hills, a sweet kid named Grace Tyler was waiting to hear from me, and I knew that sooner or later I had to call. I lit a cigarette and started to walk across the Ocean Way in the nearest phone. But then, just as I was about to enter the hotel lobby, I stopped and slowly turned back toward the pier in the swirling cloak of ocean-covering fog. Crazy thought seeping into my mind like an ever-widening circle of ink into a white blotter. Until finally there was nothing but dark. I made my call to Grace and told her to get downstairs into a taxi and over to police headquarters where we had a long story to tell. An hour later. We were sitting in Ibarra's office, and Sergeant Mooney knew what had happened from the time I had first met Grace at 5 o'clock that afternoon.
Well, Marlowe, looks like June Drake meant what she said in that note. She took care of Melnick, Mrs. Jaffe, and then herself. Did they recover the body before you left?
No, Sergeant, they didn't. And I don't think they will.
You mean the undertow?
No, I don't. I mean something a little more treacherous.
What are you saying, Phil?
That this whole thing was a frame, Grace. The interested parties, Hugh Jaffe and your sister June. The object, get rid of the difficult Mrs. Jaffe. The means, have June Drake kill her without keeping her intentions much of a secret, and then have June Drake pretend to kill herself. The result, the police never bother looking for June Drake, and when all is forgotten, June and Hugh Jaffe get together in some other city under some other name.
Oh, no. No, Phil, I don't believe that. I don't believe any of this. I can't. I won't. I don't
see how you... Hold it, please, Miss Tyler.
I'm sorry.
Go on, Phil.
Well, this part's a guess at the moment, but I think it'll hang together. Mrs. Jaffe wouldn't give Hugh a divorce.
Jealousy?
Yeah, that and one idiosyncrasy. The Signora was crazy about money, and since he was doing the running around, a divorce would cost him much more than he was willing to pay.
Which means that although Miss Tyler here hired you, you fell into the stellar role of the patsy, star witness. You would always be close enough to later tell a story they wanted told, but never close enough to actually catch June Drake, who had already murdered twice tonight.
Right.
Then, Marlowe, big question. Where is June Drake now?
That is something I worked on all night, and I almost had the answer once. I almost caught June at Melnick's flat in the Palace Arms because I surprised her. She thought I was going to Mrs. Jaffe's house at the time, but I changed my mind. Remember, Grace?
What?
Oh, you must remember, baby. You were there. You're June Drake.
Well, Phil, now that we've picked up Hugh Jaffe and it's all over, I still don't see how you actually knew that Grace Tyler and June Drake were one and the same.
I was lucky, Mooney. When Grace called me at Hugh Jaffe's house right after she called as June, I heard a bellboy in the background over the phone. But I didn't think much about it at the time. Yet Grace claimed to be at her hotel in Beverly Hills. It wasn't until I began to think of the whole thing as a frame that everything fell into place. The clues planted so I couldn't miss them all the way down the line. The book of matches, the mink, the red hair was a fall. And another thing, Mooney. Hugh Jaffe was much too surprised when I told him that June Drake had killed Melnick, a man. He expected the murder of his wife, Margarita.
Well, why did June kill Frank Melnick?
Because he was blackmailing her. You see, Melnick knew that June had murdered her first husband. June was stuck. She couldn't let her future husband know what had happened to her past one. So she included him in as victim number two. Besides, that's the only final payment she can ever make to a blackmailer.
Mm-hmm. Then, Marlowe, June Drake is the real person that never actually was a sister named Grace Tyler, was it?
No. No, I guess there never was a Grace Tyler. Ever. Night, Sergeant. Outside, it was that strange time between the end of one night and the beginning of the day that follows. And when I looked up, I could see that the thick, heavy fog that had been with me ever since I first met the woman called Grace Tyler was lifting, breaking apart, so that here and there it was only thin, spiraling wisps above which rose the pale, gray promise of a nice tonight. As I walked along, it seemed to me that there was less and less fog. Until by the time I'd gone a few blocks, I was sure that I could feel fresh air, cold against my face, and clean. I figured I might walk until the sun came up.
Adventures of Philip Marlowe, created by Raymond Chandler, star Gerald Moore, and are produced and directed by Norman McDonald. Script is by Mel Donnelly, Robert Mitchell, and Gene Levitt. Featured in the cast were Lynn Allen, Lillian Byath, Edgar Barrier, Whitfield Connor, Ann Morrison, Lou Krugman, and Jimmy Eagles. The special music is by Richard Orant. Be sure and be with us again next week when Philip Marlowe says...
An iron skull was their trademark. Their business was climbing walls, and it was all done on wheels at 70 miles an hour. But that was a cinch for the death cheaters until they felt murder with a feminine touch.
Sunday is the day when CBS brings you the tops in comedy, but it's also a day when you'll find big-hearted Danny Clover patrolling the Great White Way. Broadway is my beat, says Danny Clover, and every Sunday he brings you a new adventure along the main stem. On CBS Sundays, you'll also find Dashiell Hammett's one and only Sam Spade cutting another of his famous capers. Broadway is my beat, and the adventures of Sam Spade are regular Sunday features on most of these same CBS network stations. This is Roy Rowan speaking. Now, stay tuned for Gangbusters, which follows immediately over most of these same stations. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that, ladies and gentlemen. About 20 seconds into it, I realized I told you a falsehood. That wasn't Van Heflin. That was playing that part was Gerald Moore, and he took over the show a little bit later after Van Heflin left for other grounds and territories. But he certainly has the voice for it, doesn't he, Gerald Moore? I mean, he was a very interesting actor, and I think you heard enough of the show to see that you got a little bit of Chandler's talent there in terms of description and plot and twists and that type of thing. He was a great, great detective story writer, and I'd recommend reading some of those books if you've never done that in the past. Well, thank you for joining us tonight, and look on the billboard on the course on the website for the show, Jumbo Justice Radio Show, and we'll have something for you next week, and I'm sure we'll be meeting again. Good night.
We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Always do till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.